key interview with Kelso in 91, key interview with Fuller in 74, which I assume was the first time you interviewed him.
First, no.
Those are priceless in understanding you and your own roots. And, and I found it interesting you bringing up Kelso in 74, but I told Carolyn that you probably just heard about Kelso in 73 or something, a year before.
Right? It was right around then, but let me introduce you, and it's Robert Dobbs, Bob Dobbs, well known to his friends and colleagues and so forth. And he's a media ecologist, is the way he bills himself now. I've known him for many, many years, and many people around New York and the world know him as one who is very, very familiar with the writings and philosophy and implications of the thinking of Marshall McLuhan, among many others, including Frank Zappa.
Yes.
And others. And Bob, it's really good to welcome to the program once again. And we were just chatting that... you have been seeing some of the programs that are being streamed here out of MNN on your computer and reporting that it's coming over loud and clear and of interest. And you gave me a call and said you had been interested in some of the things we did. And you said that we ought to catch up on some of the implications of Marshall McLuhan. And so that's why you're sitting in that chair and we're talking now.
And your guests had canceled, so you needed me because I didn't call for that intention of being
on the air. No, not at all. We were just talking like catching up. And so I was really glad we could put it together. Now, maybe quickly, you can give your old background. You've done it on other occasions where we've talked with you. But you knew the man, Marshall McLuhan, who was one of the great giants in terms of understanding the implications of communication technology, I think it's fair to say, on the human condition and so forth. Maybe share your own background a little bit, and then we'll get into some of the things you've seen from the programs streamed your way.
Yeah.
I get word from Jeffrey in Moscow. He watches it in Moscow. That's pretty revolutionary that these programs are streaming. But share some of your background, please.
Well, you mentioned my acquaintance with McLuhan. I knew him well, but I knew a lot of people in the 20th century. I was born in Paris in 1922, and I actually, as a young man, through my father, met James Joyce, I met Gurdjieff, I met all kinds of characters.
You met James Joyce?
Yes, yes.
You did?
Yeah, when I was 16, 1938.
Good God, he's a giant.
I met Wyndham Lewis and all those people that were in Paris at that point. My father was... You've heard of the legendary Priory of Sion, this mythical thing that the Da Vinci Code is based on. Well, my father was a member of that, brought in as a Johnny-come-lately because the we call them plutocrats, oligarchs that were in Europe that organized the Priory of Sion, which was something not exactly the way it's laid out in the book, but my father being a butler and our family being butler for these people for 300 years.
Some of these landed aristocracy out of the feudal days.
That's right. They go way back, and after World War One, they'd considerably weakened. And so my father was brought into the intelligence services around his employer and their buddies.
Some of them private.
The secret international network, beyond national.
It's not Bilderberg.
Bilderbergers is more around the Rockefellers.
Right.
These people go back, they're called the Fondi.
Fondi, right.
F-O-N-D-I. And the wealthy members of the family, of these families, don't have any power. It's the trust fund itself and the lawyers and accountants. And that's why, you know, often members of these families, if they misuse their lifestyle with that wealth, they get killed because it's the preservation of what Marshall McLuhan would call visual space, which is
visual space,
which is the product of the printing press for 400, 500 years ago, the concentration of the printed money, the credit, and the gold. And that little solid thing that was put together, for example, Thomas Pynchon's book,
Gravity's Rainbow?
Yes, The Decline of Lot 49 talks about the Turnin Taxis family. Now, they're an example of a family that goes back 500, 600 years because they brought in the postal service in Europe. And so that was a new technology. Therefore, the intelligence agencies of that time had to bring them in. So the Turnin Taxis is an example of these Fondi families.
Fondi has a literal translation?
Fund? It's Italian for fund. Trust fund.
Early banking, early establishment on capitalist terms.
Basically around the printing press.
Right.
You know, 1500 and that. Because then you could concentrate a centralized banking for nations, but the interplay between the bank of the nations had to be coordinated at the central banking level, and that's where the intelligence agencies were. And the people who have a conspiracy view of history in the 20th century aren't aware that that wealth collapsed in the 1920s. The owners of those trust funds dissipated, and money became public property. It was no longer private property. Now they...
Along about 1913?
No, 1929-30, the collapse of Wall Street. And that spread around the whole world. And then money became a public property at that point. And now it's moved into information.
Uh-huh.
And so money, the people I'm talking about were sitting on the sidelines in the 30s and 40s.
Mm-hmm.
They were only able to get back in the game in the 80s when the government funded, basically in the United States, the loans that went out all collapsed by the late 70s. You know, the third world loans and the oil involvement with that. And as a result of that, there was no one left with money other than these oligarchs sitting on the, historic oligarchs sitting on the sidelines, who, because they never made loans, only were clever and intelligent investors for 500 years. They are the only ones who had the money. So that's why Prince Charles got married in 81, and as a representative of those European oligarchs, started moving around and having a lot of influence. Then in the 90s, when the digital economy comes in, that scattered everything, and actually money freaked out, and the offering of the medium itself went ecstatic in the late 90s, and you end up with the Enron situation where people are giving themselves nothing and claiming they got a lot of money, and that collapsed. So
that did, but yeah.
But now we're here with a unilateral, no basis for wealth other than punch the other guy out. So it's a Paleolithic thing. But let's take the reason I'm here. And so anyways, I'm a consultant about those matters.
Right.
And but in the course of my life, I met Marshall McLuhan in the late 50s, early 60s. And I became very interested in work. And he helped me understand what my employers, through my father, were going through. Because
they were your employers as well as your dad?
I was brought in after World War II by my father. I mean, because it was such a small network now. They've been pretty international. I mean, Charles Dickens writes about my great-great-grandfather in a story called The Toady Tree, written about 1854. If you look up Charles Dickens' miscellaneous journalistic articles, it's called Miscellany, you will see a story about the pobs, the clobs, the lobs, the knobs, and the dogs. And he describes each one of these people that are part of the toady tree, he calls
them. Toady tree. Toady to the pond.
Yeah, they start. In different life situations.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But the one that's on Dobbs is and implies the toady to the Fondy.
Because
he talks about my great-great-grandfather as someone who he would see at the West Parliamentary Building, who would be talking to you, and all of a sudden some minister would come in. And he'd run over and talk to the minister, even though he just seemed to be a lowly butler. He seemed to be very involved with very influential people. And at the same time, always was telling you what was going to happen in 6 weeks.
Uh-huh.
This is how Dickens describes my great-great-grandfather.
Really? And it was your great-great-grandfather?
Yeah. Because, and so the point is, that is a historical. That role of those kind of people was diminished after World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And they're only back in the game now. So the revived interest in the conspiracy worldview of the 90s that a lot of the Generation Xers and younger kids are into, they buy this stuff, is that beside the implosion of the media, is that they're like intuiting that actually there is a reintegrated control of a Priory of Sion or Da Vinci Code gang as there was before, because that right now, until we move into a new energy system or something, we're stuck with the purse strings of money, and it's moving in a panic state because of the electronic simultaneous dispensing of nothing, so the information becomes money. So that, again, puts back the money sitting on the sidelines. But it is a bureaucratic form of control.
Boy, you got a lot in there, starting from a Renaissance printing press and the implications of technology. And the implications of the technology was the hallmark of the thinking of
Marshall McLuhan.
And maybe it's fair to share. I find we have to share with another young people who are viewing it, Buckminster Fuller, or even certain thinking like Lewis Kelso. And that it might be well to share with some of the audience Marshall McLuhan himself. He wrote The Gutenberg Galaxy, was a great magnus opus, it seems to me, on the implications of the extension of our consciousness into the environment in the form of technology that comes back and influences and shapes us. He wrote famous saying, the medium is the message, and that sort of thing. But share a little of him, just in a primer way, if you could. And then tie it in with some of the things you were talking about, if you would, please.
In my own life, through my father, I met Wyndham Lewis, James Joyce, Yeats, Gurdjieff, other people, influential people of the first half of the 20th century.
Intellectuals
and poets. Now, it became prophetic for my own life, or synchronistic, because when I met McLuhan, I found out that he had relied on the insights of Joyce, Pound, and Lewis, Wyndham Lewis, and T.S. Eliot.
Absolutely. He was his darling. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Who had worked with people, the symbolists in the late 19th century. Now, the relevance of this is they being artists and writers at the turn of the century, they had to deal with the new movie medium and the new television and later, not television, the telephone, the automobile, and then later the radio. And so as writers, they were looking at the communication system. Now, most people weren't looking at the communication media. Like Marx didn't look at the communication media. He looked at the hardware means of production, not the software. And so because of McLuhan's studies of those people at Cambridge in the 30s, it clued him into something that a lot of people hadn't noticed. And so then when he really understood Wyndham Lewis, who was really the anchor of this, Wyndham Lewis is a very interesting historical character in this mix, and then topped it off with Harold Innes and his breakthrough academic study on the bias of communication and how communication media determines
Canadian
thinker in Toronto, how the means of communication that a society uses determines their outlook, their attitude, and actually their myth.
Right.
And so McLuhan used that launching pad to begin to look at TV as it was coming in the early 50s.
Not only TV, but he also, if I'm not mistaken, set me straight, right, that he thought that the organizing metaphor for a lot of Western civilization, linear thought, even notions of rationality, was a result of our dependence upon the phonetic alphabet.
That was a core thing.
That was the core organizing metaphor for Western civilization.
For the abstract mind. We can say the Westerns are too abstract. They're not sensual or feeling and these different metaphors for other cultures that seem to be more involved and not so detached. And that is a result of the abstract effect of the phonetic alphabet, which is a series of signs and sounds that have no reference to immediate reality.
Right.
They're based on abstract background.
Right.
Meaningless letters for meaningless sounds. So, which becomes ABCD within the culture. But the printing press heightened that effect 500 years ago. So McLuhan sort of got into that a bit in the 40s when he was doing his PhD thesis.
Right.
But then, with Innes wrapping it up and crystallizing in an academic context, he then had a way of looking at television, and then automation, and then satellite.
Mm-hmm.
And by the 50s, he became quite well known. Came out of New York media, New York people promoted him, like Tom Wolfe and Namjoon Paik.
Yeah.
He just died, just passed away.
The
TV avant-garde artist.
Yeah.
He put McLuhan on the map in the art world because he was using McLuhan to understand how TV had become an art form.
Mm-hmm.
So McLuhan used that. Now, we want to get into, McLuhan used that to understand why things were not in the old ideological context, political context, economic frameworks, all these things were subsumed by the information.
And what we want to understand are the implications of the existence. A post-literate kind of communication capability with all the film and television and multimedia extension of communication. I saw a thing on the Science Channel or one of the Learning Channel or something the other day, and they had, it was a presentation of the creatures that existed 45 million years ago after the demise of the dinosaurs and so on. And they had the best paleontologists in the world. And they presented all this stuff with animation, and they presented it, and it was the best paleontology. Mm-hmm. The research was really good, really made sense. There was not a single written word in the whole thing. It went on for about 10 hours, and it was just very good communication. And then they had them animated the way they actually looked in the environment as it was best able to be. What an educational thing. And then I got the idea, and I want to get your take on it, if I could. We'll get back to that. But the idea crossed my mind that was a hell of an educational experience, and the people at Google, I saw, what's his name, Brin, Sergey Brin, and the big thing they're working on now is having ability to have you speak in the language and then have it translated automatically into languages of the world, and I thought if they took that piece and they put a translated from the English narrative, and then they put it into, let's say, Swahili. Then they could have taken that thing and presented it to, let's say, 10-year-old kids or something like that in an African village or something like that. Those kids would be educated like crazy and the best thinking on really important subjects, science or whatever, in a language. And everybody knows how to talk without having to learn. Everybody learns how to talk. So if you translate into that language, they would be able to have an educational experience without one single written word in the whole thing. And I think that has some implications, perhaps, in terms of the educational potential for reaching people. And what do you think?
Well, it's like Sesame Street didn't train the kids the alphabet. It taught them how to consume television.
Okay.
So if you present this almost virtual unfolding like Disney's Fantasia of the history.
Fantasia is great.
If you present it in that, we'll call it photographic medium.
Yeah.
But it's really video too, so it's coming through and hitting your brain.
Yeah.
All right. How does that, those kids conditioned by that medium relate back to books?
Yeah.
Or to slower movies? Or to newspapers? You see, it's the effect of the media on other media.
Exactly.
Earlier media, not just us.
And we have a tremendous commitment to the alphabet as an organizing principle for all our institutions.
That's family.
And linear thinking.
That's family.
And
values.
Bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And all of these kind of things. I mean, it's not just the, you know. It
that's
really
the White House. See, the White House represents the alphabet as presented by the newspaper media.
Right.
The boundaries of the United States of America, which doesn't exist economically, technologically anymore. All right? And so the family values is really, in media terms, a reference to America being founded on public opinion, the printing press, newspaper and book, and the phonetic alphabet.
Yeah.
So that's really what George Bush represents. That's why the neocons came in, offering up.
George Bush represents a tie to that traditional
to the visual
way of organizing
space. Society. Yeah, to that medium.
And that affects the way of bureaucracy set up.
Right.
And linear thinking and linear structuring. And
yes,
even
but
notions of rationality.
Well, that's what it is. It's a certain kind of rationality.
That's why you might have some cultural conflict in the world.
That's what we do. If
you
look at the media, media conflict. I mean, McClellan used to say that Watergate was a battle between television and the newspaper or for the advertising dollar. Nothing to do with Nixon now.
Right.
And of course, Nixon blew it when he put up the stacks of printed volume on a post-literate medium. It clashed.
Yeah.
We looked weak.
Another big fat tome, huh?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Mr. Gibbon. Yeah.
But the thing is that we have to look at how the media condition the collectivity.
Mm-hmm.
And people wonder why the neocons seem to have the advantage since Reagan came in.
Mm-hmm.
Because each one of those neocon presidents have represented a diminishing investment in visual space, in actuality, and were a camouflage for the evaporation of the United States as an economic entity, while keeping in the TV screen the idea, yes, there is a White House and we have visual space, to the point it now represents, and is represented by Bible Thumpers, the original printed book. You see, we've gone back to the genetic origin, the DNA of visual space. We don't hold up educated Darwin or educated novelist or Fitzgerald or something or Hemingway, we hold up the Bible because that's how the onion of an American meme is being stripped away.
Explain it to the audience. A meme is like a cultural gene.
It's the collective effect of a medium that everybody is sharing.
So it's accepted almost as they do a language.
Well, they have to accept it because it's part of their economy.
Right.
You make a living out of it.
Uh-huh.
So like the fur traders, they would rely on the canoe.
Yeah.
The canoe was their medium, all right? And then they used the Native Americans to show them how to paddle that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the Native Americans were an extension and servo mechanism of the canoe.
Mm-hmm.
And then once the fur traders were taken over by the aristocrats, the landed men, which brought in, Jefferson.
Oh, yeah.
The founding fathers.
Okay.
They were people who owned land and plantations.
Mm-hmm.
So those people moved the fur traders out, and they moved in and founded the country on the printing press, on the written constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So then that led to all kinds of problems in the 19th century when the telegraph came in, and that moved the United States awareness across the world with the newspaper and the telegraph, leading to the formation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, which is the old economic printed-based money oligarchs organizing America in relation to the world economy, to the Federal Reserve, which is a private banking.
Uh-huh.
And that's due to the telegraph. If you didn't have the telegraph, you wouldn't have had the Federal Reserve.
Really?
Yeah. You can. Every economic situation, and since we'll get into the Kelso we're going to talk about, every new medium alters the relationship of the old economic bureaucracy.
Yeah, the whole relationship of everything coming out of history.
Right, all it's previous the media.
The old medium is the content of the new.
Right. Mm. Now, I wanted to get into watching Bucky Fuller. And right. Your interview with him.
Yeah, you happen to have seen the thing. Yeah. That I didn't realize that it streamed. We're going to stream it again tomorrow from the day we taped.
That's good. I may watch it again.
1974. It's a great polymath.
June 74.
Yeah.
But the thing is, and I want to comment on your interest in Bucky Fuller and your interest in Kelso, and you had the New Age guy on, Mark Vicente, yesterday.
Well, that's the guy who's... He's the one who was the major creator, cinematographer, and so on.
For
and
Who didn't know anything about Bucky Fuller, never heard of him.
Well, that's the thing that's upsetting to me in a certain sense, that the younger people seem not to have a knowledge of some of these great figures that were so prominent in the intellectual... discussion and so forth back about 35 years ago. They seem not to have been able to pick up on that.
So with that is our goal to get to that. We now take McLuhan and that tradition I was talking about media analysis, and I bring in a new phrase, Manichean satire.
Manichean satire.
It's M-E-N-I-P-P-E-A-N.
Okay.
Manichean, two
what
P's.
What is Manichean?
Manichean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Menippus was a writer. We only have fragments of him left. In about 220 B.C. in the Greek area.
Greece.
In Greece, yeah.
In Greece?
Yeah.
Okay.
In the Hellenic period.
Oh,
his associates are Greek culture. I mean, I don't know exactly where he was, but he was around Athens, or around what was called Greece.
That's going way back.
Yeah. So 220 B.C. Now, he did the outrageous...
Oh, 220, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
220. Okay,
no, 220 B.C.
Okay, sorry.
This is after Plato.
Yeah, sorry.
The thing is that he did the outrageous act of mixing prose and verse on the same page.
I see.
They were, back then, fanatics about visual space as it was just coming in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Plato took the oral tradition and put it down into a symposium, a printed book.
Mm-hmm.
That was new. That was revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
By 100 years later, there's pretty rigid definitions of how to be a writer. But we don't know why he did it, but the fact that he was outrageous in combining prose and verse, that when Varro comes along 200 years later, around the time of Jesus, he was a Roman poet, Varro cites Menippus, M-E-N-I-P-P-U-S, the author of this mixed media, prose and verse, and he says, this is unique. This is a certain kind of satire and has a satirical effect.
Uh-huh.
I write satires based on that style.
Uh-huh.
So Varro wrote many what subsequently became called Menippean satires.
Okay.
Though later, 1700, John Dryden called them Varronian satires because we had more of Varro's work than we had Menippus's work.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
satire.
Yes.
Why satire?
Because it was not, Menippus was a cynic, which was a particular philosophy. We know that Diogenes, the famous guy, walked around with a barrel on, looking for an honest man.
With a lantern.
Yeah.
Looking for an honest man.
Right.
I had a friend who tried that here at one time. You know.
Well, he was maybe a cynic. But that's a technical kind of philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
The cynics did not have a philosophical system, bunch of ideas or this and that. Their agenda was to wake people up.
Mm-hmm.
So they would basically shock people in their sensibilities in different ways.
Satire?
Well, coming into a party and urinating on the host's fireplace.
That'd do it.
You know, that kind of antisocial behavior.
Yeah,
But they did it consciously.
Mm-hmm.
And they became known as the cynic.
Okay.
And Menippus, because he was a cynic, that philosophy got tagged on to Menippean satire.
Mm-hmm.
And so in history, as many Menippean satires were written from 400 A.D. on, often they were looked on as to be written by cynics.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily. But the interesting thing is that a Menippean satire has to change with every new technological form that comes in. So in history, if you look up Menippean satire, it'll say it's a long symposium of philosophers talking, very learned people, and will show the clash of their ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And the satire is not on some virtue, not on some vice, or on some inadequacy or human flaw. It's on learnedness, on learning. It's a satire on learning. So they will present people, these are...
Satire on learned fool. Okay,
yeah.
Or the people that are supposedly learned but are not
right. So there's a lot of very large extent of erudition in these written works called Manipian Satire. Right. Because the
so-called intellectuals that are falling short of the job.
These are intellectuals writing them.
Yeah.
And it's like
they're poking fun or barbs at the establishment.
Yes.
Acceptance of
knowledge, of the high priest of knowledge.
And what the intellectuals in large are coming up with in and falling short.
Showing how they fall short, showing the contradictions in their philosophies as they argue with the other philosophers, showing the...
And their shortcomings.
Yes,
the
shortcomings.
Vision.
Right.
Would it apply to today, perhaps?
Well, and this is what I'm leading up to. I'm saying if you read a definition...
Because there's a big failing on the part of the intellectual community on the world planet today in terms of what the future
this
requires.
This is what we're leading. This is where the relevance I'm going to bring in relation to Bucky Fuller and Kelso.
Good.
So if you read a go to the Wikipedia or Encyclopedia Reading Description, you'll see it's a learned satire, and learned. And it's often written 1,000, 1,500 years ago by grammarians.
It's now the Comedy Channel.
Right. Oh. So the grammarian, they would let off steam by vomiting all their knowledge and making a satire almost of themselves.
Okay.
So it was a means of waking up, making the high priest of knowledge, the scholar, aware of their limitations.
Right.
Not to pretend. Yeah. To make fun of the life of ideas, in a way.
Right.
Now, when in 400 A.D., a major Manipian satire was by Marcianus Capella, and it had a different... Constantine.
Yeah, right, okay, yeah.
And it was
there
called...
There was a whole lot of shaking going on.
Yeah, and it was called the Marriage of Mercury and Philology.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, shaking. The papyrus, the Egyptians had... removed the form of communication the Roman Empire was bound by, which was roads and paper routes. When the papyrus was withdrawn, the Roman Empire collapsed. So that's the time of Augustine, 400 A.D. And so you're moving into the Dark Ages, which is a different media complex.
Was there a connection between the two, the papyrus and the fall of the empire?
The Egyptians withdrew papyrus, so the Romans could not organize with the paper routes their vast center margin structure. So it collapsed, and we moved into what was called the Dark Ages.
That's how they communicated on papyrus?
Yes. And the roads. Paper routes and roads was the innovation of the Roman Empire.
Okay.
Built on what Alexander the Great tried to do, but he didn't have the papyrus to organize it.
Right.
So that's where the medium is involved with politics and power.
But they played tablets or something.
Yes, that was before. That's Babylon in that.
Yep.
I mean, the papyrus and the portable, scroll was the beginning of the Greek unique, the unique Greek.
Go on. So the medium of communication.
The medium of and it was withdrawn.
Together,
And altered people. So the first, the Manipian satire of that period comments on that effect. I'm describing how you say it was a turbulent time. Yes, because the medium was pulled out, creating a new medium, which was a lack of paper medium, moving into the Dark Ages.
Okay.
Now, you wait another 800 years and you get the beginning of the mechanization coming out of monasteries, say 1200 A.D.
The feudal period.
Yeah, and at the beginning, we're going to get to the Renaissance, but there's lots of innovations happening, clocks and new things coming up out of the monasteries, and beginning of universities in Bologna in 1000 A.D., and the beginning of...
Oxford's
about 12 or 1300,
okay,
I think.
Yeah.
But Bologna was the first university in the Western world.
Yeah. Unless you count Alexandria.
So my point is that a new Manipian satire shows up by a writer named Alan of Lille, L-I-L-L-E.
Mm-hmm.
And it was totally different from the one 800 years before by Marcianus Capella.
Mm-hmm.
But it basically was a satire on the situation. And that's because a Manipian satire seems to show up whenever a new medium comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Because the new medium makes the old established mode and medium seem quite obvious, so then you can then get a clear view of it, and you satirize people still stuck in the old medium and ignoring the effect.
We need that now, I think.
We're coming to that. I'm going to tell you that.
Yeah.
And so the next time is the printing press.
Uh-huh.
We have two major Manipian satires that show up.
Uh-huh.
Don Quixote, Cervantes' Don Quixote, where the guy's running around trying to redo the medieval period and the romance of the feudal ages, and it doesn't work anymore because that world is not there anymore, because the printing press has moved it from feudal into a mercantilist. Beginning of capitalism.
And
the other one was Rabelais. Rabelais, Gargantua, and other of his writings were notable for their cursing, for the blurring of words, for digressions, for claiming to tell the truth and then talking, laying out blatant lies.
Mm-hmm.
All this these various characters of the Menippean satire, including early, it's a kind of early science fiction, claiming they went and saw the gods, they went to the moon and talked to them. All these kind of characteristics of that Menippean satire up to Rabelais. And then there's Pope, which is the beginning of the newspaper, Alexander Pope's Menippean satire, the Dunciad. But now we're getting up to today. The next big one, basically 800 years after Alan of Lille in 1200, and 800 years added, 1600 years from 400 with Marcianus Capella, is Finnegan's Wake.
Okay.
Now, if you ever look at Finnegan's Wake, it's an unreadable book on the surface. Mm-hmm. It's impossible.
Yeah.
It's made up of a...
Beyond
Yes, way beyond Ulysses.
Yeah.
And he has 60-plus languages collaged in every page.
Yeah.
And it's Finnegan's Wake that Martin McLuhan, nearly 50, saw was a Menippean satire.
Mm-hmm.
And he did in-depth research in Menippean satire.
Mm-hmm.
And then he adopted a Menippean stance. He says, later in his letters, people didn't know it unless you were around him, a friend of his.
Some of those probes of his.
Yes. Well, it was all Menippean satire.
And drive people crazy.
Right. Now, here's how we get to what we're leading to today.
Okay.
Is that, why would he do that? Well, he recognized, with the speed of electronic technologies coming down the pike, radio, television, automation, computers, and then the instant replay.
And internet now.
So we're speeding up
that
800-year cycle to 4 years, 6 years, 10 years for a new medium to come in. Therefore, the pulling of the rug out from a society that's using one medium has speeded up.
And all the institutions predicated upon the implications of that medium.
Yes. Now, that happened in World War II with radio. Every new medium will cause a war until we recognize this pattern.
That's what's causing the war.
On a more general view, it's the old...
Because it undercuts the sense by which people gain a sense of identity.
That's right.
What the future is.
And the old power structure.
Yeah, and the old power structure.
Yeah. So that, you know, we could say the American Civil War of the 1860s was a railway war. The effect of the telegraph.
Or the cotton gin, maybe?
No, telegraph and the railway.
All right, okay.
And since the electric media decentralized society, that was the impetus for the South to withdraw from the North.
Mm-hmm.
They felt strong, but of course they were fooled by the industrial might of the power of the North. So you
had an industrial revolution coming.
Right.
The steam engine comes 1776.
That is hardware. Mm. Overlaying that is the telegraph.
Okay.
Which
you're looking at communication.
Yes.
Okay,
and the software effect, the global village effect of the telegraph, actually thinks that you can remove yourself from the industrial structure. So the South felt that they were stronger than they were, felt that they could be removed, but they were being hypnotized by the telegraph effect, and that was not going to become a real, you know, industry until another 50, 60 years. So under the impact of the new media, they felt superior, but then they collapsed because the industrial structure just came and walked over them. It's still there. Now to show this too, in the 30s with radio coming in, the less industrialized countries, Japan, Italy, and the Germans, because they suffered after the reparations of World War I, they were weakened. They felt superior under the acoustic effect of radio. Literate industrial Americans and British.
Didn't McLuhan say that Hitler could have never survived in the television age?
No, but the neocons do well in the television age. But that's right. So radio, radio caused a new war, and the Japanese, the fascists, and the Nazis felt superior, and Mussolini and those guys. And the point is that they didn't realize that they were like on a drug, and they collapsed and were beaten. Because the larger effect of industrial media still rolled on.
Industrial and post-industrial, or is there any point?
That's after World War II.
Okay.
Yeah. So, the point is every new medium caused a new war. What did TV cause? It caused the Vietnam War. Maybe you could even say the Korean War, but it caused the Vietnam War and then all those others.
You say TV caused the Vietnam War.
Yes.
Spell that out a little, because a lot of people thought it had to do George Kennan's containment and all kinds of more traditional
Those are the older media.
Uh-huh.
So in the 50s, as TV moves in, it makes America, which has a world empire, bureaucratically speaking.
World empire, not in the old colonial sense.
No, in a decentralized post-radio, but they ran the purse strings.
Appropriate to the emerging post-industrial order.
Yeah, they ran the purse.
Neoliberal models and things like that.
They ran the purse strings. So they loaned everything and created that pretty rich period in the 50s and 60s.
Didn't have to send Tommies out with Gatling guns.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. So Under the impact of television, though, the visual idea of spreading on the planet was made claustrophobic. The first effect of claustrophobia in America was the McCarthy period. There are communists everywhere.
There were commies everywhere.
Yeah, and he was looking at hardware communists, bureaucratic communists, where what was happening, television was creating a software communist environment, a free world of information, which could be entertainment and knowledge. So that's the first effect of television. And then when you bring in the satellite in the 60s, that threatens the American population, which is now in the 60s, gotten used to television. And it also threatens the Pentagon, and they need a place to have Custer's last stand. The world is shrinking so much that they still want to have a war. And this is the cannon and the containment against the old communist bureaucracy. But America is more communist technologically than any country ever could have been.
More communist technologically.
Yes, the pension funds owned everything.
Uh-huh.
But also in terms of the services that people engage in. Uh-huh. Radio, newspaper, and TV, relatively free.
Uh-huh.
But taking the old industrial military complex, it needs to find a place to vent its own technology, so it goes to the Far East and goes into Vietnam, all in an identity crisis within the TV satellite complex.
I mean, what a way to see things.
Yeah.
Okay, that's an interesting way to see things in software terms.
It's a way of quickly reviewing history for a young mind to say, look, you got all this information, you can't go in the library and read all this stuff. Here's a way to do it. Look at the medium, know the medium will create a war, watch how it affects pop culture and all the older media, and you get to have a way of having a handle on all this history.
So where do we stand now? Well, we're extending the central nervous system in computers and satellite technology, and it's moving now. We've got carbon 60 coming now. There's going to be exponential increases in the capability to have information in overabundant capability.
So let me bring in the Minipede satire.
No, that's
good.
I want to get to the present.
Yeah, we're getting to the present. So I'm saying that McLuhan looked at Minipede satire, which originally was mixing media.
Mm-hmm.
That was a simple definition, prose and verse.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see that the Minipede satire's written ones through the history of the last 2,500 years would mix new kinds of media as content, as entertainment, as the satirical ploy, in response to a new medium. So here's McLuhan in the 1560s looking at how would I be a Minipian satirist to wake people up. I'm not proposing concepts, I'm proposing percepts. What is the actual
body percept.
And collective percept, which is symbolized by the meme and the media. The media is a meme. So how do you do that when, due to speed up of TV, satellite, and computers, we have a Minipian environment? The media itself is having a Minipian satirical wake-up effect, but a paranoid, panic wake-up effect. We have global identity crisis all over the world in every culture.
Right now?
No, I'm talking the 1670s.
You don't agree? Okay.
Oh, we're getting to that.
Yeah.
So you have the Mao Revolution, the Children's Crusade in the 60s in China. You had the Brezhnev knocking off Khrushchev. You have the students going nuts in Europe and here.
They did. There was something blowing in the wind, Bobby Dylan.
Yeah. You had
and there was.
Oh, there was.
Yeah.
What was the clash of all these different memes and different technological situations.
One of the assumptions, if you take a certain view of Bucky Fuller to bring him in, is that there was something going on collectively in the zeitgeist and stuff, which he added up trying to get at the idea of haves and have-nots, and he said that we were, on the one hand, reaching a point where the weapons were so destructive that apparently it was about 1970 that we had systems that were in place, the extension of special theory of relativity and so on, that if they were to be unleashed in a spasm of hate, could very well mean the end of the whole species, which was an existential moment. And on the other side, he made the claim that it could be, and it's a claim that would be investigated, worth investigating intellectually, is that in terms of our capability, we were, in terms of having haves and have-nots in the world, we were reaching a point where our capability, our design capability of providing life support within an ecological context was reaching a point where that design capability that we had evolved as extensions of our consciousness in the environment was one where we could see by criteria that had to be agreed to and so forth that we had more haves than have-nots for the first time in the evolution of human society. We were transcending scarcity in the evolution of events, and we had a capability to make things work in a new and liberating way, which had not been characteristic of the historical experience. That's his view of it.
Yeah, now that
you see, why don't you tie that into McLuhan and the idea that there was a qualitative transformation We've been gestating for 200,000 years. We're now coming into a new relationship to the universe, the cosmic consciousness. You could bring in Chardin and the notion of the noise sphere and the, you know, the idea that we live in a time of qualitative transformation and the evolution of consciousness itself in terms of the wider evolution of consciousness, maybe even on a cosmic scale.
Okay. Now, McLuhan was a good friend of Bucky Fuller.
They got along well. Yeah. They met in Bahamas in 1970.
Oh, no. They started corresponding in 61. I have the correspondence.
Okay.
And in 1961.
They were giants both. Yeah.
1961, yeah. He promoted Bucky Fuller in the 50s. He was aware of Bucky in the 40s.
The Fuller life.
Yes. But here's the thing. Taking this Manipian satire theme, that the environment, the mix of TV, computers, and satellites, and radio, and newspapers, and all the content, and all that great stuff of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that is a Manipian environment. It makes people wake up. Uh-huh. In the sense, it shocks them that I'm no longer in the old meme, I'm a new meme. I may not catch up to the present, which is three memes down the way.
Wait, the present is three memes down the way?
Yes, most people are responding to TV news in the 60s.
Driving into the future with their eye fixed firmly on the rearview mirror?
The turbulence of the 60s was caused, generally, cliche-wise, by television. And what people saw Vietnam on TV. Mm-hmm. Little did people see was the creeping in of the digital world, the computer world, and the satellite, which went around the whole planet.
Well, one of the things that could be put forth is that there was being picked up, as Bobby Dylan put it, he said, there's something blowing in the wind, that there was being picked up by human sensibilities and so forth, this idea that we were at a qualitative transformation in terms of the evolution, that we were, it is as existentially significant that we can destroy the whole bloody species.
Okay, but you said that.
Hardware.
We're running out of time.
It is existentially so significant. We were transcending scarcity as an ontological
but
reality.
But you said that, and here's the point. What McLuhan says...
That's what was blowing in the wind.
So Marshall McLuhan said, okay, Bucky, you're talking about scarcity in terms of housing, food, and some basic industrial things.
No, and the information, and understanding, and knowledge, and all the rest of it. You're coming to
I got it.
Of,
let me say
okay,
this. So the point is, the information environment, he can understand, the electronic environment is relatively free, but Marshall said, and now I quote,
I quote
from your interview with Bucky Fuller, 1974. Bucky says the young kids don't listen to their parents because the parents are saying the same thing that's on the TV. All right? Because everybody was getting their news from the TV.
No, I don't think quite the way.
Let me tell you how. Let me just say my bit. He said that the kids are becoming less victims of authoritative knowledge passed down.
From their parents. They're picking it up from other sources.
And what he said is that, you listen to the tape, he says, they noticed that their parents were saying to them what was on TV. So why listen to the parents? Watch the TV.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that this would lead to... freer thinking people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was the naivety that Marshall would try to correct them on. You're looking at content information, Mr. Fuller.
Mm-hmm.
You're not looking at the formal
effects of
TV on older media and on the satellite on TV. And so what happened in the 70s, or when you brought in cable TV and what that revolution that would be, is that you had incredible fragmentation of information sources.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody getting into expressing themselves through video cameras and all kinds of media and all the art. And no consensus was established. Therefore, the sense of community disappeared by the 80s. And I'm saying that, I could go in a lot more detail, but the point is that Bucky Fuller did not see, as Marshall predicted, Marshall predicted in 1970 we would move into a depression.
Mm-hmm.
Not a economic depression, a psychological depression, because community would be removed, community based on older media, as new media came in, and as those medias turned over faster, everybody was getting into jumping on them. And by the 80s, you have that yuppie mentality, or whatever you want to call it, say it's a cascading term, of people jumping on the digital environment and ripping off the world economy and local industries and hardware industries all over the world.
You had all that me decade stuff.
Yes.
Scientology and S and all that stuff.
And you know what that was? That was the effect of the satellite.
Uh-huh.
The satellite, here's Bucky saying people are going to listen to TV or at least be autonomous from their parents, but he didn't see that the satellite would make a mentality in the young generations where they want to do their own thing, which became the me decade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we bring in Kelso. Kelso wants to, in your interview with him in 91, it's very interesting how...
There's many with him. Yeah,
yes, but that was the one I saw, just before he died.
There are many more. We'll be able to get him on our site soon.
Right. Now, Kelso, another important thinker, And who McLuhan quoted in the book in the late 60s.
Oh, yeah. And Bucky Fuller said was an important person all the time.
Right. In that interview, he talked about. Yeah. Now, Kelso, his plan got bureaucratized as ESOP, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now,
well, it got, it's like saying Leonardo da Vinci only painted one painting or something.
Right. But here's the point. His agenda was based on the idea that capital was no longer labor, but the technology itself. Therefore, putting labor on the sideline. What Kelso missed is that the information requirements and the content requirements of all this expanding media environment
mm-hmm.
would move hardware labor, which was being obsolesced by robots, into software labor. And software labor, everybody getting into the information environment in all kinds of ways, either being a cameraman or a broadcaster or traveling the world as a correspondent, all these media resources meant that the division between labor and capital, and his solution was to realize that the labor could become owners, all right?
The masses could become owners.
Missed the point that the system could not be bought or sold or stolen, basically couldn't be owned anymore, because it had become digital. The only owners left were the oligarchs sitting on the sidelines, and they could only watch from the sidelines.
Well, and didn't I give you, was it with you? I think I gave the figure that they had in the New York Times. That the ownership of capital, that he said that in Tom Jefferson's day, maybe 10% of the actual production was the result of human activity, labor.
Right.
And that's not just labor wheelbarrows. That's guys thinking and everything, right? And that had in the American economy, which is in a certain sense a trend setter for the world trending and so forth, that had probably shifted, and that the actual production in the modern economy is probably only accounted for about 10% is labor now. It was 90% in Thomas Jefferson's day. It's now about 10%. But for the vast majority of people in the societies of the world, the only way they have supposedly to legitimately get income is by having what they call a job.
Right.
And it's never discussed that the 90%, which is actually responsible for production, which has to do with all kinds of intangibles and so forth, a capital asset, that's now owned. 57.8% is owned by the upper 1%. And the other people are all, in a certain sense, what Marxists would call wage slaves to the few who own the technology.
But let me bring that in. But what are those people doing? Those people have got their transistor radios. They've got their digital, their computers, or variations of them. I mean, in Africa, they got wind-up satellite clocks, and they just rewind them every 20 minutes.
That's $100
The point is, you can be a homeless person, and you can engage. You can engage in the information environment. You can call in and be content. The whole population around the world gets involved in participating in making information. And that skewers the brilliant plan of Kelso and Fuller's vision if we don't consider the effects of this media involvement, which then creates a reaction of people being threatened. So then when Thomas Frank writes about the Kansas Democrats vote for Reagan, which will bring in industries that will remove their jobs, all right, why do they vote for Reagan and the Republican Party and undermine their own local lifestyle? That's because they don't live in Kansas. They live on the media. Now, I call that the TV body, an organism that's adapted, that grows on top of it. Then they grow in the chip body. So when you bring in an election, an old newspaper environment called Congress and the White House, with a bunch of people expressing opinions based on literacy, that becomes a nostalgic artifact. A nostalgic artifact and a source of comfort in relation to the fact every day when you turn on your media, whatever you're using, you've got to form a new identity in relation to whatever the news is coming at you.
Yeah.
All right? So all those psychological, sociological factors have to be considered in any agenda for moving to a utopia or oblivion.
Well, okay, that's one of Fuller's books is that. But you can go to Lord Maynard Keynes or something. If you've got a situation where the actual way in which things are being produced is changing from the labor involved in the actual production of goods and services, and that would include information products, films, everything like that kind of thing, is now overwhelmingly shifting from one where the labor input to that is not as relevant as the technological extensions or capability that can be represented through corporate assets, and those corporate assets are owned by a few, and it also has the ability unlike the agricultural revolution that went on when we had everybody worked on a farm at the turn of the century, and then they all went into the factories in Detroit. Lord Maynard Keynes said in 1930 to his grandchildren that they are going to be confronted by massive unemployment. That
but hardware terms.
They're going to have the capability of putting people out of work massively. They just fired 30,000. Everybody's saying, well, okay,
I know this. We know the 50. Harold, we know the 50. We know it. Everybody's put out of work. But you know what they go to work
but
doing? They get their welfare check, and they listen to the radio, and they call into Rush Limbaugh. If nobody called into Rush Limbaugh, then he wouldn't be paid. The
people are involved
in the information exchange.
They're
a source of wealth.
But they get their welfare check through a system of Franklin Roosevelt done kind of
right. That's Keynesian economics.
Keynesian, right. And that's money,
is a public property.
And Lord Keynes said in 1930 that they are going to be confronted by massive, and the only legitimate way
but
that
they are unemployed. They're
the
only unemployed, if you look at their chemical body, mm-hmm. is unemployed in terms of doing physical labor in any form.
No,
any kind
their
of
their input to production.
Right,
things
but you know what they're producing every day? They're producing. They're in TV studios being the audience for all the shows. They're phoning in on talk shows. They're on the email, interneting. This is especially North America. Mm-hmm. They are participating. Their TV body is working and involved and giving their opinions about the issues of the day mm-hmm. and very involved now blogging. Mm-hmm. Whereas their chemical body is the one that Keynes predicted, which would be destroyed.
Well, they have a body,
but not their TV body.
No, but
the Manipian environment is mm-hmm. the mixture, because we're running out of time here.
The mixture
of the chip body and the TV body and your chemical body,
mm-hmm.
and I even put in the astral or spiritual body, which mm-hmm. is your own cultural aspirations for another world or something, whatever you feel is the inner.
Well, that
content.
Might be the synergistic resonancy of a liberated humanity. If
right,
you
no, but this interaction—the interaction of these four bodies—creates
mm-hmm.
a Manipian situation
okay.
for every one of us. And it was called the rise of irony in '80s.
Mm-hmm.
In the '80s, in the '90s, on shows like Jerry Springer, where people would jump on and make fools of themselves, but that didn't matter because they weren't too worried about what
the
TV body.
What do you think is the are you optimistic, pessimistic for the human prospect? We live in a time when we have weapons systems
okay,
that destroy the whole species.
I understand.
Or do you think we live in a time where there could be some sort of a transformation, the means by which people have gotten a sense of identity, the institutions coming out of history have been obsolete by the context by which the technological environment. Do you think there's hope that we'll find a way of organizing the world society that will be liberating of humanity within an ecological context that seems to be at a design level available to us now through some sort of economic system that relates to
new media coming in every day?
Are you optimistic or pessimistic concerning the human process?
I wouldn't take it
irrelevant.
The question's irrelevant because
okay.
I have to tell you which body. If you understood, if people understood what I'm saying.
I'm talking about human beings.
Yeah. If people understood
concept.
What I'm saying about mm-hmm. the four bodies
mm-hmm.
and started to implement that as a political dialogue to state exactly our situation. The chemical body has been ruined in North America by the medical industry. You know, my wife is an expert
know,
on that stuff.
Okay.
I mean, there is apocalypse and Armageddon going on in the chemical body,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even the spiritual body because of the psychological pressure that people feel.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is the apocalypse for the TV body in relation to the chip body. So you've got all kinds of battles going on. And to put any images of disaster on there, none of our images live up to it. There's nations in Brazil and that. These countries, their kids are deformed. They're malnutrition. We've got way beyond any biblical apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
But we're still here, and we can understand the situation if we talk about it in a clear term. And being aware that the information environment as a Manipian environment is undermining anybody who
mm-hmm.
holds a press conference to state a position of what we should do.
So where are we going to get our sense of direction? What is the likelihood 10 years from now, 20 years from now for planet Earth?
Cold future. The China.
Well, you're talking about some energy sources.
Yeah, that's going to come out of China.
Well, that could come from somewhere. And that's going to be the solution.
That'll be the breakthrough on the big level.
Uh-huh.
That will move us out of the software tyranny we're in.
Mm-hmm.
This hyper-production, hyper-expression
mm-hmm.
that all countries are communicating, all media going back and forth among the four bodies. The only way to break that out of that is into a new energy form, which deals with energy for shelter and food, and that will be coal fusion, and will be based on Ponson's license breakthrough in '89, and that will first happen in China, because with Bush in the Middle East, and as that gets bogged down once they involve Iran, and Saudi Arabia can't get their oil out, then China will need that oil, And they're the one really spanning this decade. Mm-hmm. So they're going to have a big industrial structure. And they have a different mentality. They want to save their culture. They consider themselves the oldest civilization on the planet, all right?
Pretty old, 5,000 years.
So they will preserve them. And to do that, it will be not locked into the oil mean. And they will ask, give us some alternative sources of energy. 9 different sources will be offered. They will pick cold fusion. And that, by the year 2020, mm-hmm. 2012, will begin to be an environment in China. And that will spread through the world over the next 30 years. And that'll be the breakthrough. We'll have moved out of the software environment, the manipulative software environment, into a hardware situation of a new hardware energy,
uh-huh.
which we would never had before. And that's why the Mayan calendar ends in 2012.
Uh-huh. And Ray Kurzweil says it's singularity is near about 2030.
2030,
actually.
Yeah.
I think it would be 2030. He's writing about that kind of thing. Well, you've thrown a lot in there, and we got some links to your site.
Yes,
and with some things that can go to this to spell that kind of thing out and so forth. So it's really an interesting take on things, bringing in Marshall McLuhan and some of these.
And Bucky Fuller.
And Bucky Fuller, yeah.
And Kelso. I'm trying to show a critique to have you, when you talk about the singularity, what have we got, 10 seconds?
No, we got about a minute.
Okay.
A minute and a half.
My point is, I've been on 5 or so times here, Harold. Mm-hmm. And I listen to your show a lot, and you keep bringing in this 200,000-year point, singularity.
Yeah, we're closing quotes on
post-scarcity. But
yeah,
we're
about to come into a new relationship.
Yeah, but don't say it. We've said it many times, and your listeners mm-hmm. know. The point is that we need to have a different way of looking at the meme that you cite. We need to bring in the informational media dynamics to have a clear understanding of why McLuhan thought Fuller would not fully grasp the situation. I'm not saying that McLuhan's a greater mind than Bucky Fuller. I'd say that they were equal in their contribution,
mm-hmm.
but we need to bring in the media awareness, and especially mm-hmm. the manipulative nature of our information environment, so that we understand when we adopt any program or a benevolent action we think we are going to do for the human race, you're mm-hmm. always going to be covered. It's going to be reduced to a soundbite, and dealing with that, the information environment, is our problem today.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to get out of it until we have a new hardware.
Until we have a new energy break.
Yes.
Essentially,
yes.
I hear you saying. Well, I would say we need the design capability and so forth. And
I think that would fit that.
Thing can come.
Yeah, Bucky predicted that.
Yeah. But I'm not at all sanguine. I would say if you were taking bets, I would think we're probably, if Nick the Greek, we're probably going to destroy it.
No, some of that.
The whole planet.
Not the whole planet. Some of us will be destroyed.
Uh-huh.
I think some parts of the world will survive. I think Australia will be something. If we do have big nuclear
on the beach
war.
They were down.
Yeah, yeah.
On the beach at the end there were a couple people left.
I think Australia could survive any war in the northern part.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. Bob, thanks a lot.
Very good.
And you can look up his research and further findings on the Manipian meme and all that sort of thing. Happy to present it. Always good talking to Bob Dobbs and so forth. Your pleasure. We invite you to come back again tomorrow. Once again, Bob, thanks for everything. Give my best to Carol.
Yes, I will.
And we invite you to come back again tomorrow. Thank you very much.